Peter B. Collins, News and Comment, Monday, November 25th, 2013. The big story worldwide, we've cut a deal with Iran over its nuclear intentions. But closer to home, Roger Shuler has a birthday today and turns 57 while unlawfully detained in the county jail in Shelby County, Alabama. One of those times when I wish I could send him a cake, you know, with a hacksaw baked in it. I just never understood. And Roger Shuler, according to news accounts, is bearing up pretty well. There is a fresh interview that was conducted in the jail in Columbiana, Alabama, just a few days ago. And it's published by David Krijek, who publishes at whowhatwhy.com. David wrote an article about the Shuler case about 10, 12 days ago. He has been in Alabama, although that's not his home base, and he managed to become the first reporter to snag an interview in the jail with Roger Shuler. Now, based on the photograph here, it was conducted by video phone, which means that Shuler is considered so dangerous that he's not allowed to have what are called contact visits. That's where you're in the same room with your visitor, and you can actually touch them, based on whatever the rules might be. Now, it's possible that nobody in the Columbiana jail is allowed contact visits, but I would be surprised if that's the case. These non-contact visits are usually reserved for very dangerous inmates. And the only danger that Roger Shuler poses is that he's committed to telling the truth. He's quoted by David Krijek. He says, "Free press, free speech, the First Amendment, none of this means anything to these people," referring to Rob Riley and the court that has put him behind bars. And Shuler continues, "I don't see any reason I should remove the material. Is a person obliged to take an action based on a judge's unlawful order?" He said, "It's not real fun being here, but I'm doing okay." And Krijek recaps much of the case that you're already aware of, if you're a regular listener here, about the alleged defamation and the claim raised by Rob Riley and Liberty Duke. What I find interesting is that Krijek has dug up more about the judge who's been pulled out of retirement to preside over this case. His name is Claude Nielsen. He spells Claude without an E on the end. And it turns out this is not the first time that he has been tasked with a special assignment from the Alabama Supreme Court. And as we reported to you last week, Krijek notes that last week the U.S. Supreme Court was reviewing the spate of death penalty convictions coming from Alabama. The death penalty sentences were imposed by a judge after the jury declined to do so. And since 2000, this has happened 27 times nationwide, 26 of those cases from Alabama. And Justice Sotomayor points out that the most likely explanation for this is that judges are elected in Alabama. And if you know this history, Karl Rove first showed up in Alabama to run election campaigns for judges. He had a partner, Bill Canary. Karl got Bill's wife the U.S. attorney post. She then proceeded to indict Don Siegelman. The first case got flushed. He was reindicted by a different U.S. attorney. We're told that Laura Canary had no involvement from that point on, but the record contradicts that. And Claude Nielsen was a candidate for a seat on the Alabama Supreme Court back in 1994. And in a campaign ad, Nielsen touted his fidelity to capital punishment, boasting that he had looked in the eyes of murderers and sentenced them to death. Now, he lost that election, but he has been called on frequently to preside over special assignment cases like Rob Riley's. And in one of those cases concerning alleged misdeeds by a judge in Mobile, Nielsen explained in an interview with a TV reporter that he uses a gut-feeling judicial style Quote, well, I've been a judge for 35 years. I've watched people testify, and I just had the feeling on some of them. It's just something that if you've done it for as long as I have, you kind of size up people and kind of have a gut feeling that maybe they may not be telling the truth. So that's the kind of judge. The judge with a gut feeling. And I have no idea how big the gut, the physical gut, of Judge Nielsen is. But his capacity to objectively rule on the law seems to be seriously impaired by that gut that he is so proud of. If you're able to, the Schulers can certainly need your certainly use your help. They need your help. Drop by legalschnauzer.blogspot.com, and there's a PayPal button there if you are able and so inclined to help. And speaking of help, I get a lot of help from the people who subscribe to this program, like Anna Gordonier, Richard Sessler, Carl Hesterberg, and Gunnar Gunderson. Thank you, one and all, for your support. And I always like to alert you, you can sign up for a subscription to this podcast. A dollar gets you a 24-hour pass. $5 a month, you can cancel anytime. Or the best deal is that $50 annual subscription. And I still have one or two copies of Bill Ayers' Public Enemy, that's our current bonus book, for new annual subscribers. And we will add to that with a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee. While they last. Sign up today at peterbcollins.com. Just follow the link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage. So over the weekend, late Saturday, I learned the sketch details of the deal that has been cut with Iran. And I've been a sharp critic of Secretary of State John Kerry. He's logged a lot of miles, but not logged a lot of accomplishments. And I commend him and the Obama administration for pursuing this deal. Remember back in 2008 when Obama said he would at least try to talk to Iran? And John McCain said no, 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 no. In fact, even though he had a cold on the campaign trail, John McCain favored his audience with an attempt to sing this little song.
Bomb, 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 Iran.
Bomb, 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 bomb,
yes, bomb, Iran.
And what really becomes very clear in the aftermath of this tentative agreement. It's only a six-month interim deal. It puts a halt on things, but it's not permanent. It's not perfect. There's no doubt about that. But the critics who have already surfaced, driven by Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel, we'll get to some of his quotes in a moment. What we see here is two very stark worldviews. One is that Iran is pure evil. Like you never, ever trust them, and any deal that you make with them can't possibly work. That they have evil intentions, that anyone who thinks otherwise is simply fooling themselves. And I take a different view. I don't think Iran is perfect. I don't think that they always have good intentions. But they've made a significant effort here to convey to the world that they want to make a change. And you can get into the nitty-gritty of the deal that's been cut. It stalls enrichment at about 5%. They can't add any new centrifuges. And we have to keep reminding people, as our media fails to do so, that Iran is a signatory to the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which means that they are allowed to enrich uranium for medical and electricity-generating purposes. And one of the things that is still in dispute is whether they have an actual right to enrich. They claim they do. The U.S. is trying to finesse that particular issue because of Israel. That's what it all comes back to. And secondarily, we have to be concerned about Saudi Arabia, which has taken a more aggressive posture toward Iran. And I want to recommend that you catch up with the latest articles by Pepe Escobar. We have a Boiling Frogs post interview coming out with him any day now. And he focuses on the role of Saudi Arabia, what he calls the Wahhabi, that's for Saudi, and Likudnik, that's for Israel, axis. He also has some very interesting things to say about Turkey and its role in the region. But fundamentally, I commend the Obama administration for tuning out the Zionist voices, not only those coming from Jerusalem, but Americans of the Democratic and Republican parties who are more loyal to AIPAC and the State of Israel than they are to the interests of the United States. And it pains me to say that. But I believe it's true. And what we're seeing now are the forces of reaction fueled by Israel's posturing. And as an example, on our local radio station here in San Francisco, KGO, Ron Owens has been holding forth for over 30 years, and he is a self-described Zionist. So today, he began his program with an interview with John Bolton, a man who is so in the soup for Israel that it isn't funny. He's a neocon. He was part of the Project for a New American Century. He was Bush's last UN ambassador who wanted to blow up half the building or something like that. And so Owens conducted an interview with Bolton and then took calls from his listeners who shared various levels of alarm. And it's all based on the worldview that that Iran is pure evil. And they dismiss everything the Iranians have offered, everything they've said. They simply flatly believe that Iran wants a nuclear weapon and that this is just a game that they're playing to try to reduce the impact of the sanctions as they continue their path toward a nuclear weapon. And, of course, this is further made bizarre by Israel's possession of nuclear weapons, even though we all play the cat and mouse game that, well, we can't confirm that. And so here we are carrying heavy water, that's a nuclear metaphor, for Israel against Iran. But what is in the best interest of the United States is this deal with Iran. And this at least delays any effort by Israel to persuade the United States to launch such an attack. But that doesn't stop Bibi. Quote, today the world has become a much more dangerous place because the most dangerous regime in the world has taken a significant step toward attaining the most dangerous weapon in the world. Israel is not bound by this agreement. The Iranian regime is committed to the destruction of Israel, and Israel has the right and the obligation to defend itself, by itself, against any threat. As Prime Minister of Israel, I'd like to make it clear, Israel will not allow Iran to develop a military nuclear capability. And he, of course, never acknowledges the hypocrisy of his position as he's sitting on the only nuclear arsenal in the Middle East. And so we hear his exaggerated position. Of course, the government in Iran is a regime. That's the code that they're bad people and they deserve to go to hell. And, of course, the phrase that Iran is committed to the destruction of Israel is hyperbole. Sure, Ahmadinejad and other Iranians have said that they want to wipe Israel off the map. But I believe that that is an expression that gets lost and kind of amplified in translation. There's no question they'd like to see Israel just disappear. They'd like to see it removed from the map. Does that mean they want to bomb and kill Israel with nuclear weapons? I think it's a little far-fetched to carry it to that extreme. Now to the latest revelations about the national security state. According to a Dutch publication called NRC, The NSA infected more than 50,000 computer networks worldwide with malicious software designed to steal sensitive information. This is based on documents provided by Ed Snowden, the former NSA contractor. They use a system called CNE, Computer Network Exploitation, at more than 50,000 locations. Here's an example. In September of this year, at the Belgium telecom provider Belgicom, they learned that the British intelligence service GCHQ has been installing malware in the Belgicom network in order to tap their customers' phone and data traffic. And get this, the Belgicom network was infiltrated by GCHQ, that's the British equivalent of the NSA, through a process of luring employees to a false LinkedIn page. So it's a very sophisticated way of implanting this malware, and it's run by a special department at NSA called TAO, Tailored Access Operations. Public sources show this department employs more than 1,000 hackers. And as recently as August of this year, the Washington Post published articles about the NSA TAO cyber operations, and they say that NSA installed an estimated 20,000 implants as early as 2008, and by mid-2012, this number had more than doubled to 50,000. And absorb that information against this backdrop. The New York Times on Saturday, in an article bylined by James Risen, the embattled NSA reporter who is being prosecuted, being forced to reveal a source, at least that's the government's attempt, he's resisting. Risen co-authored this with Laura Poitras, the filmmaker who is collaborating with Glenn Greenwald, Bart Gellman at the Washington Post, and others. The latest document from Ed Snowden that they have revealed is a white paper from February 2012 entitled SIGINT Strategy 2012 to 2016. Signals Intelligence is shortened to SIGINT. And what this is a wish list. It's an effort by the NSA to expand its abilities, both technologically and legally, to capture information. And their goal is to be able to acquire the data the agency needs from anyone, anytime, anywhere. That's hauntingly similar language to what Ed Snowden used in his first interview in Hong Kong last June. And this article by Risen and Poitras, by the way, it says that Risen's in Washington, Poitras is in Berlin. I wonder what kind of encryption they used to write this article before they published it. But it once again points out that we've been told by NSA leaders like Keith Alexander that 54 terrorist-related activities have been busted up by the invasive unconstitutional surveillance of the NSA. And again, congressional staff members and other critics say that the use of such figures by defenders of the agency has dramatically overstated the value of the domestic surveillance programs in counterterrorism. And just maybe the NSA will have to scale back its dreams and reshape them with the reality of what's been revealed in 2013. Next up, I want to fill you in on a bunch of protests that are underway at various points around the globe, starting with my backyard of San Francisco. President Obama flew into San Francisco here on Monday morning, and taxpayers picked up the tab. He gave a speech urging Republicans to move forward with immigration reform in the House. And then he's sticking around to tap the California ATM for campaign cash for Democrats for next year. It's not for his campaign. He's raising money to try to reshape the Congress, hopefully with more Democrats. That's his hope. And there are protesters protesting drones, protesting the failure to move forward on immigration reform, and other issues, including NSA surveillance. And I think that if the president really wants to win back the House, he should spend less time raising cash and more time addressing real problems like the mess that is Obamacare. That will have much more impact on Democratic election fortunes next year than raising, you know, another $1 million here or there. Other locations of protest in Pakistan. Thousands of demonstrators protesting U.S. drone strikes blocked a main road in Peshawar, used to transport NATO supplies to and from Afghanistan. It was led by the PTI party, which in turn is led by Imran Khan, a former international cricket star and the guy who lost the election last year. It's also a big protest over the weekend in the Ukraine, in Kiev, because the president there, Viktor Yanukovych, cut a deal basically with Russia at the expense of the European Union. And politics in the Ukraine are heavily corrupt. And we've got Tymoshenko, a female former prime minister behind bars in a hunger strike, and she is hardly a pure person. She was corrupt, as corrupt as they come. Also, 100,000 turned out in the streets of Bangkok on Sunday, demanding that the prime minister step down amid claims that her government is controlled by her brother. And we also have, on the flip side of the coin, Egypt, the new military dictatorship there that took power in a coup July 3rd that the U.S. still can't call a coup, has announced basically a ban on any public gatherings of more than 10 people. The only exception is you have to get a permit 3 days in advance of any protest. The new law also bans gatherings in places of worship. And of course, Friday services at the mosques have been an important point of communication for the various liberation efforts in the Middle East, sometimes referred to as the, at least formerly, as the Arab Spring. And I referenced Pepe Escobar and the Boiling Frogs interview that'll be out in the next day or two. Over the weekend, Egypt announced that it is downgrading its diplomatic relations with Turkey and expelled the Turkish ambassador because of provocative criticisms of Cairo by Turkey's prime minister. Turkey responded, neener, neener, neener. They're not going to permit an Egyptian ambassador into Turkey in the near future. Last week, we learned that there was a drone strike in Yemen and another one in Pakistan. And the Washington Post reports today that this is a very important indication that the CIA has not relinquished its control of the militarized drones, particularly in those regions. Now, if you recall, 6 months ago or more, when John Brennan was angling for confirmation to run the CIA, having come over from being the drone czar at the White House, he and Obama gave these public comments that, you know, they really wanted to see the CIA return to a pure intelligence role and that it's better to have the Pentagon control the drone strikes. And it's real obvious to ask, why hasn't this happened? But it begs the question, why did they float these ideas in the first place if they weren't going to follow through on them? And a man from Yemen came to Capitol Hill last week and was trying to talk to members of Congress. His brother was an imam who met with a couple of guys from Al-Qaeda to try to get them to stop committing terrorist acts. And the entire group was taken out in a drone strike. And this man could barely get a hearing on the Hill. We still pretend that these drone strikes are secret in many ways. And now we see that despite the talk of making changes, John Kerry's promise that the drone program over Pakistan was going to end very soon, none of this is true. And it just further damages the credibility of an administration that is suffering in the cred department in a very serious way. I meant to mention this a couple of minutes ago when we were talking about surveillance, so forgive me, but I want to interject this here. Last week, we put out an in-depth interview with NSA whistleblowers Bill Binney and Russ Tice. And if you haven't listened to it yet, I hope you will. There's a lot of important information, notably why it is that the NSA doesn't know how much Ed Snowden was able to access, how much of their secret data. But Tice followed up with an email today, and he included a link to a CNN report that's a couple of months old. And in it, the reporter shows that thieves have been able to break into cars using a mysterious little box that apparently reads the codes and the frequencies used by your infrared key fob, the remote control that unlocks your car. And they're able to walk by with this box, flip the locks, open the car, grab whatever's in it, and walk away. This indicates that the device is not sophisticated enough to start the car, but it is sophisticated enough to read the frequency used and decode the codes to unlock the doors of a car right in front of it. And Russ Tice tells us that this method has been used by the FBI and intelligence services for many years now to access autos. And he said that if they really want to find where these boxes are coming from, they could go to the Homeland Security Department, CIA, NSA, or the FBI. So this is just another indication of the power that they have over us in the digital age. After almost a year, an 11-month investigation, the Connecticut State Police Department has said it cannot determine a motive as to why Adam Lanza went on a shooting spree at the Sandy Hook Elementary School, where he had gone to grade school, last December. And I am pleased that this report is finally being published. But there have been these layers of secrecy around Sandy Hook that are inexcusable and very much inappropriate. They tell us that, they can't release the 9/11 calls because, well, it'll upset the parents. And I'm sorry, you know, we have things like this that occur all across the country. And they didn't make the 911 calls secret in Aurora, Colorado, or in Tucson, Arizona, or anywhere else. And it just raises questions about why they feel the need for all this secrecy. Now, there was a report today that ran to some 2,000 pages, finally released, but it's heavily redacted. What are they keeping from us? It is this type of behavior by government that leads to conspiracy theories, whether they're warranted or not. And so we learn more about Adam Lanza. He was described as autistic or something in that zone, and he lived alone with his mom. They hadn't spoken in months, and yet she was planning to take him to shooting ranges around Christmas time. That was one of her gifts to him. And so this is a family that shared a fascination with firearms. And then tragically, Adam Lanza, clearly a troubled young man, but I still don't know exactly why, killed his mom and then went to the elementary school and went on a shooting spree. And we still don't know about the initial reports of a possible second shooter, of someone who ran into the woods. We don't know the details yet of how he actually got into the school. Did he shoot his way in? Was he allowed in? And again, the secrecy that they have imposed, this blanket over the truth, raises more questions than are answered by this partially released report today. And finally, I want to recommend to you an op-ed piece that was published in Sunday's New York Times attributed to Professor Lawrence Jacobs of the Humphrey School of Public Affairs at the University of Minnesota. And he's comparing 3 years in the fate of Minnesota as compared with its neighbor, Wisconsin. As you know, Wisconsin is run by Republicans. Scott Walker is the governor who's busted unions and done all sorts of things he's rejected, Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. And so this professor has compared and concludes that while it's still early and, you know, 5 years from now we might know more, he says 3 years into Walker's term, Wisconsin lags behind Minnesota in job creation and economic growth. And the backdrop is that in Minnesota, they raised taxes while Walker claims to have cut taxes in Wisconsin. Walker promised to produce 250,000 private sector jobs in his first term, but the number is less than 90,000, and Wisconsin ranks 34th in job growth. Walker's defenders blame the higher spending and taxes on his Democratic predecessor, but Minnesota is the fifth fastest growing state economy, with private sector job growth exceeding pre-recession levels. Forbes rates Minnesota as the eighth best state for business. And so when you look at this, while the Republican philosophy and promise is that lower taxes and less government yields economic growth and job creation, well, it just isn't so. Thanks for joining me today for News and Comment. And once again, happy birthday to Roger Shuler behind bars in Alabama.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.